House Committee on Business and Labor. And before we go into it and get into a heated discussion on anything around here, neither one of these bills are going to pass as written. There's a lot of negotiations going on. There's a lot of amendments. I'm sure probably several versions before if anything passes. So just come on up when you come and talk about why you think these concepts are a good idea or why not and how they can be made better. And I would appreciate it if you just keep it to that, because neither one of these are going to pass as written. So I just want to share that with everyone in case anybody gets their hair on fire.
I'll just quietly ask people to do that. If we see we're getting away with time, then I'll go to that.
So, and we have a lot of people signed up. We have just under 2 hours. I think we can easily get through these sign-up sheets. But if you can be concise and brief and to the point, I'd appreciate it, because if you're going on and on, I'm gonna have to cut you off and move on to the next person. So if you can keep it within 2 to 3 minutes, I'm pretty flexible on that. But if you can, that'd be greatly appreciated. With that, I'm going to forgive me. That's all about the two bills we're going to hear. Now, before that, we're going into I'm going to open an informational hearing on accountancy and transparency in public contracting, and call Sean Moulton and Nathan Newman. And Sean and Nathan, I want to share the same things with you. Let's be concise and to the point and germane to what we're here for today. And I'd appreciate it. Please, thank you. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay. Sure. Well, thank you for having us to this hearing. My name is Nathan Newman. I'm Interim Executive Director with the Progressive States Network, which both works with state legislators around the country, but also is a lead organization, what's called the Coalition for an Accountable Recovery, which is a large coalition about across many different issues, different even ideological groups at the national level, but often working in states, to talk about how to have the data, the information, to make sure that the money going out to the states and around the country are actually going to the job creation everybody cares about. OMB Watch, where colleagues Sean Moulton is Director of Federal Information Policy, is another lead organization in this coalition. And our joint presence here...
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Would everyone shut your phones off? Go ahead.
So... our joint presence actually coming out here shows how important we see the model of what Oregon's discussing out here. I'm also an author of the December 2007 report, Privatizing in the Dark, The Pitfalls of Privatization and Why Budget Disclosure is Needed, which highlighted many of the problems of contracting across the country. I do want to emphasize why the concepts, the bills being discussed together, are so important as sort of models for what all states really are going to have to do in some form over the next couple of years. We really applaud Oregon for promoting this kind of ideas. The new American Recovery and Reinvestment Act contains significant funding for the states, but part of the conditions on that funding is greater transparency, tracking of jobs, the quality of jobs, and what's going to happen. And the provisions aren't there just because they're ethically desirable, they're sort of goo-goo government. The idea is that they're practical fiscal ways to track what's happening and make sure that the millions in often unnecessary expenditures that have happened in the past on some contracting doesn't happen in this recovery. Most importantly, it will help policymakers across the country identify the programs that actually create jobs and those that don't, and make sure that everyone as quickly as possible can move funds to the programs that do create these jobs. Now, the unfortunate reality is almost no states in the country are tracking the data needed to meet the requirements of the American Recovery Act. I mean, the final details of what's going to be required haven't been written, but there is no question that states are going to actually be able to say, both for contractors and subcontractors, where the money's going, and you hear it every day, how many jobs are being created. And that's the basic data that often people have estimates, but they don't actually always know. Just a few of the... few of the parts of it. Also, the information is going to actually have much better sort of completion status on a regular reporting schedule of like when programs are going to be created, and detailed information on all subgrants and subcontracts to meet the data requirements of the 2006 Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act of 2006, notably sponsored by then Senator Obama. I mean, it's worth emphasizing that the senator has been very committed to this issue long before, or the now president has been committed. So this is why we see the bills being discussed here today. It would be a model for implementing the kind of data collection needed. And I will note, the public is incredibly focused on this issue. Recent Lake Research Partners and Topaz Partnership poll found that 72% of the public thinks it's extremely or very important that companies that receive government contracts make wage and hiring information open to the public. 76% see it as extremely or very important that information on state government contracting, including the number and quality of jobs, should be on publicly accessible websites. So this is definitely part of a big debate out there amongst the public, and you can see it in the news stories that are increasingly looking, where is the money, when's it going to be out there? And I would say, despite the fear around costs, the experience of states and the federal government has been that transparency is not only cheaper to initially set up than most expect, the cost savings are close to immediate in many cases, and they pay for themselves many times over. Let me emphasize that whatever official fiscal estimates show up for these bills, and I understand there are core rules on how you do your fiscal notes, experience and multiple studies argue that instituting the accountability measures proposed today will save the state money and potentially large sums of money. And with the federal government, and this is worth emphasizing, offering financial help to institute better data collection and transparency measures as part of the American Recovery Act, this is the right time to move forward on capturing those savings for your taxpayers. Now, let me just emphasize the cost of the lack of data, since that's, you know, right now, I'm sure everybody, given where things are looking at the cost of implementing this, it's worth looking at the cost of not doing so. Beyond the requirements of the Federal Recovery Act, which are going to put a lot of pressure on states to do this, I want to emphasize that, as we detailed in our report a few years ago, Privatizing the Dark, most contracting out by government are done with too little oversight and essentially without the data collection that I would know private sector contracts would usually have to make sure they're getting value for their contracts. They don't always evaluate the best practices for spending the public money over the time. As President Obama said last week, as he put in place new accountability measures for defense contracting, quote, "The days of giving government contractors a blank check are over." And his estimate, based on GAO studies and others, is that this could potentially save federal taxpayers about $40 billion a year. A GAO report last year of 95 major defense contractors found cost overruns of about 26%. So part of the evaluation has to be not only what contractors should receive government contracts, but also, as President Obama noted, when government outsourcing for services is and isn't appropriate, and whether there's been lost expertise of contracting out too much. And I will say, beyond sort of like the worries, there's often the sort of promise of a free lunch from contracting. People often say, okay, they're promising to do it. We don't have to look at the cost jobs created. You know, some of the failures of contracting in the last few years across the country have been pretty spectacular. If people follow Texas, they had $1 billion deal with Accenture around their social services, human services contracting out, which collapsed and had to be revoked after, like, cost overruns and tens of thousands of children lost health care due to management incompetence because they couldn't deliver on the contract. But most contracting failures are quieter and happen out of the public eye because there isn't the data collected to say, are taxpayers getting value? And I will note just the four big worries that most people identify in contracting out that better oversight, better accountability would take care of. Obviously, taxpayer costs and degraded services. If you're not getting what you asked for, if it's costing more than was promised, that's obviously one of the biggest problems. And the weak oversight and lost expertise of the government itself. Often, as people are sort of sending out contracting, by not doing the data collection, you find that you don't have the people over time who can actually specify good contracts, make sure the accountability happens. So there's often a hollowing out of agencies across different states on being able to be effective in oversight. and then lost democratic accountability. And one reason the public is demanding greater accountability in data reporting by contractors is they recognize much of the data that they're demanding from government is actually being privatized out of sight. And so they want to make sure that that information is in the public debate as much as the public data on government spending. And finally, you know, which is always a worry, is the corruption of the political process. When there's revolving doors between contractors and government, what kind of deals? And even if the corruption isn't happening directly, there's the appearance, the dispiriting of the public that when they see an opaque process, there's the fears and suspicion of corruption. And so both the substance and the appearance is one worry people have and why accountability is seen as so important.
And Nathan, if I can butt right in there.
Mm-hmm.
The president's home state is the one that needs to work on that one a
Absolutely.
Lot more than this state does.
I would actually fully agree with that. But
if this state needs to at all.
That may be. I mean, but I am just sort of saying from the polls and where the public's fears. And people, I'm not saying that it's always the substance is there, but there is fears amongst the public in pretty much every state. I would say whatever the substance, there is the fear. And so oversight, it makes people feel they understand and are participating in the process. But I will fully grant many states are ahead of the queue of Oregon on the problems of that particular area. But I will also say, and this is the consensus, is just knowing what's going on has been a problem. As the Council of State Governments reported on a survey on privatization across the states, there appears to be no consensus as to the effectiveness of privatization, in part due to the lack of empirical data. They surveyed, they talked to agencies across the country, and the problem was not that the study said one thing or the other. The data wasn't there to evaluate that. And that's the most serious problem. If people are going to do contracting out, they should understand, are they getting the value for the money? And that data is generally not there. So finally, just wanted to emphasize why Oregon should act, because I know it's obviously a challenge to always move forward, especially in tough budget times. I mean, collecting more data from contractors on the number of employees, wages paid, and other detailed information is a key for state agencies in measuring and comparing contractor productivity. Similarly, reviewing past performance is important to choosing the best contractors that can provide quality public services. And cost analysis are best contractor practice, as detailed from everybody from the National Association of Auditors to many others, and can save states money pretty immediately because you start to review how best to use limited resources. But again, in a time of economic crisis, the reason we want to talk about accountability is to ensure that scarce public funds are going to contractors who can deliver the most economic bang for the buck. Each state needs to track as quickly as possible which programs are creating new quality jobs and which ones are economic dead ends. And I realize the budgeting process... I should have got mine. Sorry about that.
Well, while you're dealing with your phone, the reason I jumped in there is, you know, I see your organization's from New York. Are you from New York?
Actually, I grew up in Ohio. But
God bless Ohio, too. You know, this state, I'm not saying we don't have corruption here. Wherever there's human beings involved in enterprise, there is the potential, and in all likelihood, there is some corruption. But this state, relative to most states, every lobbyist I've talked about has talked about how the small amount, if any, corruption in this it exists.
Right.
But Nathan, you come into my hearing room and start talking about that and referring to the president, who I'm the biggest supporter of in this room and in this state, it just kind of hurts my feelings. And I just wanted to share that with you. Thank you.
Sure. So that's fair enough. And as I stated at the end, I didn't lead on the problem of corruption or even as good government. Yeah. I think this is about jobs.
It is. Everything we do in here is about jobs.
You know, I was stating what are the four reasons that people usually talk about transparency.
You.
So this was
Thank
not...
Thank you for clarifying that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So... But, you know, and this is why I think that it is most important. We've been working with folks on the issue of making sure the funds are going to the places that can create jobs. That's the priority. And, you know, the problem has been, and to restate this, people want to know how many jobs are getting created, and that data is very hard to come by state. And that's, I think, one of the things, and I will say, we wouldn't be here saying Oregon's bill is most precedent-setting if it was about corruption, because lots of states have all sorts of anti-corruption stuff in place. What's precedent-setting about the bills being discussed today are talking about the number of jobs, wages paid, the quality of jobs, and getting a handle on that information is what we see as exciting and what is most important at this point. Now, just going back to the cost, though, because I know that's a big hurdle. I mean, Sean Moulton will, in his testimony, talk about many of the details of savings from around the country. But let me emphasize OMB Watch's own experience in helping set up the federal USAspending.gov website. Various federal contractors claimed it would cost millions of dollars to implement the 2006 Act. They ended up working with a number of folks for less than about 10% of the initial estimate. And the savings, people are already starting to see it. So, and just to return to a final point, because I know this is driving almost everybody's decision, there is funds built into the accounting and administrative. We'll see how it works out, because all the details aren't there, but the federal government wants to make sure that transparency is something that can be included in stuff you can bill the government, in the federal government. So I do want to emphasize that. So just to conclude, by implementing stronger data collection from all recipients, making that information more accessible to citizens, not only will Oregon fulfill the requirements of federal recovery law, they'll ultimately be saving money for their own budgets and strengthening the sort of trust and understanding of the public of what's happening with the public dollars. And I think that's what everybody's looking for around the states right now.
Thanks. As Nathan mentioned, my name is Sean Moulton. I'm the Director of Federal Information Policy with a group in D.C. called OMB Watch. And we are a small nonprofit that works for creating policies or advocating for policies for more open and accountable government. I wanted to come here today and talk. Well, I echo a lot of the points that Nathan made. I wanted to really emphasize some of our experiences in implementing something like what Oregon is thinking of doing, although not as bold and not as far-reaching on some areas. As Nathan mentioned, in 2006, OMB Watch launched a website called fedspending.org. It allowed the tracking of federal contracts and grants, cooperative agreements, all sorts of spending from the year 2000 through 2000, now through 2008. And it was a real step forward for federal spending transparency. It was built on two pre-existing websites, two pre-existing databases, the Federal Data Procurement System, which was contracts, and the Federal Award Assistance Database System, which was grants, contracts, cooperative agreements to the states. When we launched that site, or we were preparing to launch it, we didn't think that the government would actually act upon the law that was being considered by, sponsored by Senator Obama and Senator Coburn from Oklahoma. Not because we didn't support the law, we supported the law a great deal, we just didn't think that Congress would pass a law that was introduced for the first time that year. We thought it was going to take time for people to realize how important such a step was. As the Congressional Budget Office looked at how much they thought it would take to implement the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act, they estimated $4 million in the first year, 2007, and a total of $15 million over a five-year period for building the site, running the site, and putting the information out there. We built and ran Fed Spending for the first about year and a half for $300,000. I wish we could say we did it for less. We certainly would have liked to have done it for less, but we were breaking a lot of new ground. We really hadn't done any of this ourselves, and so it did turn out to be somewhat expensive, and we were trying to push the envelope in terms of bells and whistles. We have online advanced search. You can search by geographic area. You can actually go into a map function and scroll down and have the map lay out congressional districts to see where the money's being spent, who gets the money, what the money is being spent on in terms of products, services, how much competition was initiated for a particular contract, how much agencies are spending, what their top products and services are. So we really did try and sort of build a Cadillac version, and we built that for $300,000. Not surprisingly, when the OMB found out about this, the Office of Management Budget in D.C., they didn't get any money appropriated to implementing the FFADA law, and so they passed the hat, and the most they could come up with from the federal agencies was about $1 million, far short of a Congressional Budget Office's estimate. So they came looking to us, and we actually wound up licensing to them for several hundred thousand dollars the software that now is being used under usaspending.gov, and we now make that software available free of charge to anyone who wants to use it. It's considered open source software that anyone can use. It is designed, as I mentioned, to provide information from two particular databases, but with modification it can be used for any other databases, and lessons certainly can be learned from it. One of the things we've found in running the website is that while it answers a lot of very basic questions as to who gets the money, what the money is spent on, those answers just lead to more questions. I cannot tell you how often we get questions from public officials, the media, from the public, as to what were the results of this spending, what kind of jobs were created, how much money was overspent versus originally contracted. And it just doesn't answer those things. It wasn't built to do that, and its data is not being collected at the federal level, at least right now, to do that. But that is what people are clamoring for. As Nathan mentioned, the Recovery Act that was recently passed does contain a provision, Section 1552, that allows for an increase in the administrative costs by recipients, and states and cities and counties are going to be some of the major recipients of the Recovery Act money. And the federal government can increase the administrative costs over previous amounts to implement the reporting and transparency functions that are being required in this new Recovery Act. And we really do see the Recovery Act as setting a new bar. It's something the federal government hasn't tried, and many states haven't tried. Oregon is really at the forefront in even considering tracking some of the things in terms of wages, number of jobs, and the impact of the money being spent. We have seen other states, though, take on federal spending transparency very successfully, some of them. I wanted to highlight a few examples and then open it up for questioning and then get some other people up here to testify.
Sir, I'll open it up for questions.
I'm sorry.
And I'll bring people up here to testify.
I apologize.
Thank you.
The state of Texas is really one of the key examples in terms of the amount of money that can actually be saved, as Nathan mentioned. And I think they have a good example that can also be followed in terms of managing the process. The comptroller, state comptroller down there, started with their own budget, with their own spending, put that up in a database, eventually expanded it to the top agencies, put them up in a very simple database, and a series of phases moved up the functionality of their website until it was only at the very end that they actually moved to a contracting phase where they actually spent money other than existing resources. They spent $300,000 to build their website, which gives a lot of the same kind of capabilities that I was talking about that Fed spending does. And in the first year of operating, they have estimated that the increased transparency has helped the state save $4.8 million and identified an additional $3.8 in potential savings. Now, most of this came from simply recognizing duplicative contracts, money that could be saved by combining certain other contracts and get cost savings with agencies combining their purchasing power and getting better costs for the entire state government. In Missouri, they have an accountability portal as well that was built using almost entirely state resources, existing resources, and they were very proud of that and announced on their website. Over this past summer, the National Taxpayers Union in D.C. Went through that system to help identify areas that they thought were ripe for better controls. They identified $1.6 million that has been spent by the state employees in coffee shops, tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars in other shops such as florists and framing supply stores that, if, again, managed better into more larger contracts instead of little purchases over time, the reduction in the price that was being charged to the government could be enormous. it's examples like these that I think stress the importance in general of spending transparency both at the federal and state level, the savings that can be found. What Oregon is proposing to do in terms of the performance and the impact of the spending is really the next step, the step that no one else yet has taken, but it is very much needed. And I think that the bills being considered here could, in many ways, set an example for other states and possibly even for the federal government as they try and consider what it is they want to do to implement their recently passed Recovery Act. Thank you.
Yeah, good. Before I do open it up to questions, and I want to keep those brief because we have an Oregonian over here, Representative Riley, that wants to speak to this, who's been shepherding these through the interim. And before you nice people get on your plane and fly back east and just walk out of here thinking, well, the chair's a hostile jerk, which there may be some in this nice building that think that, but I'm very supportive of these concepts. I'm very supportive of, we have performance measures in our own budgets. I'm supportive of auditing and increasing the funding of auditing in this state, which have been decreased radically since I become a legislator, and that's most unfortunate. But the reason I'm frustrated is the federal government owns and operates half of our property in the state, which isn't an issue you guys are really all that interested in. But then I get folks coming from New York and Ohio. It just, I want you to go back to those nice places in Washington, D.C. and say, Oregonians know how to run their government. They know how to manage their resources. We know how to take care of our land, and we need to have more access to it. But you're exactly right as far as fine. There are some great concepts in here. I don't support everything in these. I believe we can get to yes, and I'm glad to hear we're out in front, especially on things like auditing, accountability, making sure contractors are doing what they're hired to do, and paying the wages of the people that they're hiring to do it. We've spent a lot of time concentrating on that and making sure the taxpayer not only gets what they're paying for, a bang for their buck, but also has a good awareness and has access to that knowledge and that information. Couldn't agree more. That I just hope you forgive me, but if you don't, that's okay too. With that, I'd open up questions of these fine gentlemen. And Representative Riley, if you'd like to come join us, please, we'd love to have you. Matter of fact, why don't you let the go? We'll just let the good representative go first, and then open it up to questions.
Thank you, Chair Schossler and
Committee. Oh, Representative, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bills 2037 and 2867. Representative, you'd like to just, you manage your time. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler and Committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. As you, some of you know, I've been working on this issue for probably a couple of years now. I worked on it through the interim and during last session. I'm an IT professional, and so I started this little project in the IT world, looking at IT contracts, and I had the Department of Administrative Services do a study for me, looking at possible savings in IT contracting. And what we discovered was that if we could look at the contracts, we could probably save, in the IT world at least, and probably in every contracting area, at least 10%, maybe 15% on contracts. And that's what we need to do for the taxpayers of Oregon. We need to look at what's going on in these contracts. We need to be able to determine if the contracts are the right ones, if they're the right contractors. This database is going to allow us to do that in a much better way. I can't say enough about the fact that this has come before your committee, and I support these concepts almost entirely. There are a couple of things, as you say, maybe, and maybe, Chair Schaffler, you gave my speech for me a little bit just before I walked up, and I appreciate that. But again, yeah, this is something that the taxpayers of Oregon deserve, and I want to see it go through. And I really appreciate y'all hearing it and hearing me. And I'll sit here and answer questions with these folks if you'd like.
Questions of these gentlemen? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I've been researching government transparency also, and I was going to be a co-sponsor here. We were talking about an even more encompassing transparency measure. I was interested to hear about the software that could be available, and how soon could this be available? What does it take for the state of Oregon to access this software?
You can download the code from fedspending.org at any time. It's available. There is some documentation to explain how it operates. It would have to, as I said, it would need to be modified. It is built on open source software. The programs we used are some very basic programs. The idea being that it would make it the most easy for other people to work with. It's not some sort of proprietary or difficult software. It's a MySQL server, not to get too technical, but a pretty basic database kind of programming language is my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions of this panel? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your testimony and traveling here to testify on this subject. And I know one of the bills before us, talks of establishing measurable standards for contractors' performance. And I'm wondering, a lot of times our public contracting codes, refer to the least cost possible to the state. And notwithstanding that, there's also talk of those sorts of standards that we expect to be met. So I'm wondering, how other states have addressed. I know the federal government has addressed some issues around that basically identify the value that's mm-hmm. delivered to the state as opposed to just solely least cost. And so I'm wondering if you can just talk real briefly about those value standards and how a state would implement those.
Well, I'll start with one quick comment. I mean, one of the problems when the major data you have is the cost and not a lot of other details is people act based on just who is offering the lowest price. The more data you have, whether it's on job creation, whether it's on past performance, future performance, the more you can actually make an evaluation that isn't just least cost as in low bid, but best value. So I think this goes to this idea of data. And I mean, this is one reason why these bills seem so important. And just to address the chairman's why we're here. We're here not actually because we think Fed should be telling Oregon how to do things. We actually think Oregon should be telling other people. These bills...
I like you better already.
Yes. No, I mean, and if you look at any of the publications we've been actually sending around to folks, we've been pointing to Oregon saying, if you want to know how to do this right, the debate they're having in Oregon is the debate every state should have, and it's because for exactly these reasons, to make sure you are talking about best value, longer term, and I'm going to come back to this, where the jobs are getting created, which is often a value that people sort of say, well, we want the services done. People do government for a lot of purposes. Sometimes it's just to get the best price, but it's also to say, are the contracts being creating long-term jobs? Is it helping to spark new industries on how the money is spent? Are they building new local? And if that's not being evaluated, you're only getting half the value of the contract. Sure, you're getting the service at whatever price, but are you building the long-term economy of Oregon? And the fact that Oregon is grappling with that is what we want to push every state to understand they need to grapple with. So, yes, to repeat, we want Oregon to run the rest of the country because the way these bills are being written, it is the model we want other states to emulate.
Chair Schaffer, are you sure these folks are not from Oregon?
I already asked them, Representative. Okay.
And I just wanted a quick comment. One of the things that we saw after the Hurricane Katrina catastrophe and the move in there of contractors to build, rebuild New Orleans to temporary housing, there were a lot of questions afterwards about some of those contracts and whether or not they got value for the amount of money that was being spent. And the reality is the federal government didn't know. They had a lot of anecdotal information about shoddy work and emergency trailers that were full of formaldehyde fumes that were dangerous to people and things like that. But in the end, because they didn't track the right information and because they did emphasize a lot of times the lowest cost for these contracts, they got sort of what you pay for. And the Senators Coburn and Obama actually, during the election season, had joined forces on a second bill that would have sort of modified their original law, the Fafata law, and they really were trying to get to some more of that idea of exactly what you're bringing up about performance, about past performance by contractors. Did they deliver on time what they said they'd deliver and for the amount of money they said to do it, or did they go over time and over budget, or did they deliver a shoddy product? So I think you are getting to a very critical issue. It's not just about the money. It's about a lot of other information.
I think there's a lot of people at the highest levels of government that did know, did have the information, and it is all about the money, and we don't have access to that information. I'm editorializing, but... Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your coming out. I appreciate, Representative Riley, your work on this bill. I think it is very hard to argue against increased transparency, increased data to make better decisions, et cetera, increased efficiency, accountability. It's absolutely a worthy goal. However, it's not unforeseeable that there might be certain times, specific contracts, small jurisdictions, et cetera, in which the information cost combined with the reporting cost exceed the benefit. And I'm wondering how can we limit this? Are there good principles or rules we can use to limit the scope of this bill so that we exclude those kind of very specific instances?
And before you answer, it won't be $25,000. That's just way too low. So, yeah. Go ahead.
But you are getting to one of the classic ones that the people try and do is they try and set a price threshold that below which you don't require this information to be reported, and it's a balancing act as to where you set that bar. It's certainly the easiest way to say if it's a small contract, the costs of collecting that information aren't counterbalanced by some sort of benefit. You're not going to get enormous amounts of wasted money in a very small contract. Some states are setting it at 50,000 contracts, 50,000 and above. The federal government has been trying to push down to about that level, and we're going to have to wait and see what they do with the Recovery Act. But that would be the main way that it gets handled.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
And then
Nathan. And then, folks, we have 20 people signed up that want to speak, and Representative Jefferson next. So go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Shuffler. Representative Barton. My take on this is actually we need to set it at a little higher than 50,000 at first and see how it goes. I think that we could even... once the software is set up, there's very little extra cost to the state, no matter how many we put in. The cost is contractors, and we don't want to put a burden on our small contractors. What we could do, however, is make it voluntary for the small contractors if they have this ability to do it without too much work. Make it voluntary and let them put it into the database if they want, and then we see how it works and maybe expand later if the contractors don't have too much burden on this. But I think we have to make it a little higher than 50,000 at this time with a voluntary below that. That would be my take. And I'm going to, if no one has any questions for me, I'm going to move on and let go back to my committee.
Well, we know where to find you, Representative.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for doing all this work, by the way. We really appreciate it.
And the other take on it, and this is especially like which data you might ask from smaller contractors versus which ones you would ask from the larger. I mean, there is data that any well-functioning business of any size keeps track of. Payroll data is something that they have to do. So if you think about some of the core data, especially some of the data you want to be tracking for federal reporting, such as number of employees, overall payroll, et cetera, you could look at the smaller contractors for a more limited set of data to make sure you're getting core data, while some of the broader internal performance review, et cetera, which might create more of a paperwork, that's where you might change the threshold. So there's also the overall threshold, and is there data that is appropriate to ask even of smaller contractors just to have that baseline of information.
And I read the bills this morning, and my first reaction was rather knee-jerk. But as technology unfolds and people are more comfortable with it, my daughter, for example, is totally comfortable with everything on the computer relative to me. And I think a lot of that reaction will calm down. Small contractors are completely computerized on the web. Their design, we have e-permitting process here in the state of Oregon. Some brilliant people sponsored that legislation, I might add. But but I think you're quite welcome, Representative. Anyway, there's that fear.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff right now probably wouldn't be that difficult to enter. But there's just this pushback, and for good reason, because we want to be sensitive to that. Representative Kennemer, and then we're going to move on, if that's okay, unless there's absolutely something pressing. And Representative Jefferson Smith, would you please join us up at the DS, too?
Gentlemen, I guess, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I'd like to see, maybe you could provide to the committee information on who makes up your coalition.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to see who all is participating.
Sure.
Thank you.
And would you please share it with the good administrator so we all have that information? I'm going to let you guys go. I thank you for coming. Enjoy our good food and beer and wine and beauty. And come back again. I hope you understand my...
Absolutely,
the way I am. If you do, let my wife know.
Let us know.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An elucidation on that latter point would be helpful. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Jefferson Smith, a member of this chamber, testify in favor of the view that Oregon should run the rest of the nation and testify in favor of House Bill 2037. I'll be brief. There are others with more important things to say than I. I think at this point in Oregon's history, drawing a closer connection in people's minds between taxpayers, voters, citizens' minds, between the taxes that we pay and the services we receive is and should be a high priority. According to the Oregon Progress Board, only 12% of Oregon citizens can both answer the question of what is the biggest source of revenue in Oregon's general fund and what is our biggest area of expense. As Representative Riley mentioned, there are chances to find savings by engaging more people in the process and sharing more information. And I also very much agree with Representative Holby's point that when we are working towards transparency, we should be considering not merely transmitting information about cost, but also quality, both spending and outcomes. Let me also just say that, to use a phrase that has yet to be used in this calendar year, in these tough economic times, the more we can draw a closer connection between the taxes we pay and the services we receive, I think the more trust and confidence we will be able to generate in the decisions we make over time. So I will be brief and limit it to that, and thank you very much for your time.
Any questions of the good representative while we have him here? All righty. Cool. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I should also mention we're also pushing House Bill 2500 that would also look at sort of bigger areas, other areas of government spending as well. Thanks a lot for looking at the issue.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. And before I call him, once again, we have both bills open, hearings on both open, so testify to both bills or whichever bill you choose. I'm going to call Gordon Laffer and Joelle Davis up first, please. And I hope I pronounced everybody's name right. Go ahead. Whoever wants to go first, please jump over.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Gordon Laffer, but I take no insult about pronunciations. I'm a professor and acting director of the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center. And for the last 5 years, I've conducted research on the economics of contracting out, on the one hand, school support services, which is bus drivers, custodial, and food service, and then more recently on the work of architectural and engineering design for the bridges and highways constructed by the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I want to share with you briefly some of the troubling findings of both of those types of research that I think could be addressed by these bills. I'm going to try to be brief. There's really three points that I want to cover. One is the importance of having rigorous cost-benefit analysis when contracting out is done or being considered. The second is the importance of transparency and having a centralized database of contracts. And the third is the importance of having meaningful and enforceable quality standards in service contracts. Let me talk first about cost-benefit analysis. Obviously, when contracting out is done or contemplated, it's done on the assumption that it's going to save taxpayers money. Unfortunately, that assumption is very often untested, and there is no cost-benefit analysis done. In the research that I've done, in every case, the savings actually realized by contracting out were much, much less than those promised, and in many of those cases, what was presented as something that would save money actually ended up costing taxpayers money. I want to briefly describe the biggest ticket example of that, which is the work of engineers designing the bridges and highways in the state for the Department of Transportation. That work is done by professional engineers within ODOT, but over the past decade increasingly has been contracted out, and again, done on the assumption that it would save money, but an untested assumption. In 2006, the Secretary of State did a partial audit of that work, which found that, in fact, it was significantly more expensive to have outside consultants rather than ODOT engineers do this work, but that was just a partial audit. The practice continued, and there was never any systematic cost comparison done until we just did this research recently. I looked at 136 bridges designed over the last 10 years, from 1997 to 2008, divided them between those designed in-house and those done by outside consultants. What I found was that for every $1,000 in bridge construction done, the cost of designing that work when it was done in-house by ODOT employees was $74. By contrast, the cost of designing $1,000 worth of bridge construction when done by outside consultants was $125. So from $74 to $125, it's almost two-thirds more expensive. Because there is such a huge amount of money spent on infrastructure spending, when you multiply this by the volume of work done, it's a very big ticket item. The bottom line is in the projects that I looked at, the work that was done by outside consultants, if that had been done in-house, the state would have saved $27 million. This is for bridge projects over the last 10 years. I want to stress two things. One is I did the calculations in the most conservative way possible that account for wages, benefits, and overhead, both externally and internally. I also discounted the most expensive and least expensive ones. What I ended up looking at, counting, was about 70% of the bridges done in the last 10 years. If we looked at the other 30% of bridges, as well as all the highways, I'm sure the $27 million figure would be larger. But so to be extremely conservative, we have $27 million at a time when obviously everybody in the legislature is looking for ways to find money for much-needed services. This is $27 million we didn't need to spend. Again, that is information about the past, but obviously since infrastructure spending is one of the few areas of government spending, both at the federal and state level, that is likely to have a significant amount of money going forward, I think the importance of just making sure that if there is going to be contracting out, it is something that saves money and doesn't cost money, requires a kind of serious cost-benefit analysis. One brief second example, smaller money but more common, is contracting out of bus service. An example that I've testified before to Chairman Schaffler about is the Lake Oswego School District. And I'll just give one fact about that, which is Lake Oswego contracted with Laidlaw, a British-owned international transportation company, and the contract included the purchase of buses. Now, by state policy, the state reimburses school districts for purchase of buses only when those buses are the property of the school district. In this case, Lake Oswego was buying buses that were the sole private property of Laidlaw. If the contract ended tomorrow, they would keep them. They had the right to use them in other districts. They had the right to use them ferrying people to football games or amusement parks on the weekends. And what the contract did was it took that money, the purchase price, and built it into the per-mile transportation fee. That was then submitted to the state for reimbursement and was reimbursed. So the school district calculated that this was a savings because the state reimburses 70%. So for the school district, it was a savings because the state was picking up 70% of that money. Now, for myself as a taxpayer, if you say you're going to save from this pocket where you pay your property taxes for schools, but you're going to pay for it out of this pocket where you pay your income taxes to the state, it's not a real savings, and it's obviously not a real savings to taxpayers as a whole. When we include the full costs, including the costs that were shifted to the state, what was presented as a savings ended up being a loss of several hundred thousand dollars. So that's in terms of the importance of cost-benefit analysis. Let me say a couple things about why I think the importance of transparency and having centralized databases of contracts. First, in both these cases, I spent months doing this research. All documents that are officially public record took a long time to get, working with school district staff who themselves have had staff cuts and are overworked and don't necessarily have the time to, you know, run around getting the information that a professor asked them for. In one case, there was a school district that I think anticipated being embarrassed by the results and told me that the University of Oregon would have to spend thousands of dollars in copying costs to get the documents, and which in the end we were able to agree were provided at no cost. But obviously neither legislators nor taxpayers nor regulators in the state have the time or staff to do this kind of intensive research on individual contracts. The Lake Oswego case that I just mentioned to you, excuse me, I called the Superintendent Castillo's office, the school superintendent. There's one person in her office who's responsible for overseeing transportation issues for all the school districts in the state. And I said, hey, this thing is going on. Is this legitimate? Is this a legitimate use? And she said, no, and could you tell me where it's happening? And the first thing that I thought was, you're the person in the state in charge of monitoring transportation. Don't you have some kind of central database that you don't need to rely on some professor calling you up and telling you stories about what's happening? And unfortunately, the answer was no. And I think that, you know, when there's not a centralized database, the only way to have real enforcement is to have a huge team of field investigators, which, again, this is your decision and not mine, but to me seems like this is not in the cards. There's not going to be a lot of field staff running around poking into contracts. So if the reality is that we're going to continue to have one person in the state in charge of bus transportation, then similarly, there's not going to be a big increase in oversight staff. Things like transparency and central database make it possible to have meaningful enforcement with minimal staff, without having to have a big staff of field investigators. I also think, briefly, that it could be helpful to school districts themselves, and just to give you two examples. One is Sodexo, a French multinational company that provides lunch services and a lot of food services in a lot of school districts. I discovered it was charging different rates of cents per meal for lunch services to different school districts within Oregon, even though it was the same service, and it was not a case of, like, Portland versus a rural district where the labor costs would be different. Now, that's something that, in my opinion, school districts should be able to know when they're negotiating and be in a position to demand whatever is the most competitive rate for these services, but they have no way of knowing. So if we had a centralized database, it would also empower school districts to negotiate for the best rate. A similar situation was Lincoln County contracted with a company called SBM to provide custodial services. It was a multi-year contract that was canceled because of poor quality performance only 6 months into it. It was such a severe situation that the district bought out the rest of the year just to get these guys off the property. Now, SBM has continued to bid in other districts. There's no way for other districts to know about what happened in Lincoln County unless they have some kind of centralized database. So again, I think there's cost saving. There's also empowering public agencies to be able to negotiate effectively. The last thing I want to talk about is the importance of having meaningful and enforceable service standards in quality standards and service contracts. And again, I want to give you one example, which I'm not trying to pick on Lincoln County, but it's one of the places that I research, so I'm sure there are examples elsewhere. After the problem that I just mentioned, where they removed their first custodial contractor, Lincoln County contracted with Sodexo, which is a multinational company, to do custodial contracting. Now, in contracting out, everyone assumes that what we're getting is the same service for cheaper money. If you're going to get a worse service, it's not rocket science to figure out how to save money by doing less cleaning. The assumption is it's going to be the same, but that needs to be written into the contract. In this case, the contract with Sodexo allows the contractor to write their own standards of service. The contract says, quote, following award of a contract, the contractor shall provide a thorough and comprehensive analysis of proposed service standards and specifications. So they're supposed to write what they're supposed to clean, then they're supposed to make an operational model providing service standards to what quality is everything supposed to be cleaned, then they're supposed to do a customer satisfaction survey where teachers would be asked how they feel about cleanliness, And then they're supposed to come up with a proposal for how their fee should be adjusted if they fail to live up to the standards of quality. So the contractor is invited, after they get the contract, to say what they should do, to what degree they should do it, and what should happen to them if they don't meet those standards.
That's good work if you can find it.
I agree. Now, the even better work,
any
if you can find it,
floating around?
The even bigger problem for us and better work for them is it turns out, none of those things were ever done. They never did write a scope of service or standards of cleanliness or a method for being fined. There never was a survey of teachers or anybody about how they feel. When I talk to the school district business manager who, when contracting out happens, it often happens at a time of fiscal problems when administrative staff is also cut. So Lincoln County used to have a manager just devoted to custodial services. That position got eliminated and rolled into somebody else who said, my quality control is I wait for principals to call me if there's a problem. Well, that may be doing a good faith effort with the best that they have, but it's not a substitute for having meaningful standards and meaningful enforcement in the contract. So I wanted to testify in support of these bills, in particular on those three items, on the importance of doing cost-benefit analysis, of having transparency and centralized database, and of having meaningful and enforceable quality standards. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Before we go to Ms. Davis, I've contracted for years and never once did I get hired to do something that after I was hired, I got to tell them what I was going to do. That's a new, novel approach. Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Just a question, please.
So let's have Ms. Davis, and then Dr. LaFrance ain't going anywhere. Go ahead, and then we'll go to Representative Kanemer.
Okay. Great. Good morning, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to present testimony in favor of improved government transparency in public contracting as written in HB 2037 and HB 2867. My name is Joelle Davis. I serve as the co-executive director of the Association of Engineering Employees of Oregon. We're a public employees union of nearly 1,100 members comprised of engineers and professional staff at the State Departments of Transportation, Parks, and Forestry. Our independent union has been organized for over 60 years since 1948. HB 2037 and HB 2867 allow contracting agencies to use past performance data when considering who to grant contracts to. This solves the problem of contractors routinely low-bidding contracts only to jack up prices, sometimes more than double their original bids through constant change orders, improper claims, and irresponsible construction methods resulting in interminable delays. You'll remember how this was recently highlighted when the Ross Brothers firm was found to have filed more than $3.1 million in largely bogus construction claims on the Ontario Bridge project in 2001. The partners in the firm actually bid each other a dollar to see who could get these false claims funded through the contracting agency the fastest. Allow me to share with you some photographs of some other Ross Brothers highway projects from the I-5 corridor in southern Oregon. This photograph shows an improperly constructed bridge support. The contractor attempted to cover his mistake, as you can see, by the concrete seams here, which are supposed to actually match up with the shape of this wooden opening here. This wouldn't have been discovered unless we had gotten notification from an employee who was disgusted with what was happening and had one of our inspectors go and pull the cap to find this problem on a bridge support. This photograph shows about 20 feet of rebar, which was improperly supported and clearly fell over like a big pile of spaghetti. The rebar construction and bridge supports is obviously vital to public safety and to the life of the project itself. And, it's not like this is something that you can reuse. You know, the steel is permanently weakened after this kind of thing happens. This is my favorite. This shows a central bridge support which is clearly bent out of alignment and looks more like a bridge with a bad case of osteoporosis. Faulty construction like this results in weaker bridges, shorter project lifespans, and great risk to public safety if they're not properly corrected. The worst part of this is that I can't tell you if the construction defects I've just shown you have ever been properly corrected by the contractors. You'd have to check with the contracting agency to confirm that. Problems like this don't happen with every contractor that does these kind of projects, but there's really no current effective way under current laws to be able to deal with these bad apples. State contracting laws allow public contracts to be overseen by the contractors themselves. That means contractors can provide their own inspection and oversight of their own projects. It's like the fox watching the hen house. HB 2037 and HB 2867 will help put an end to this by requiring that public construction projects use independent inspectors and independent oversight. There's more savings to be had through better practices and use of available resources. A recent study from the University of Oregon with our good friend Dr. Lafer of 72% of bridge projects from 97 to 2008 showed that ODOT could have saved that $27 million had they used in-house design engineers. And this study fits with findings from an Oregon Secretary of State audit from 2006 that showed the state could have saved upwards of 20% of its costs through using in-house engineers during the design process. HB 2037 and HB 2867 promote a more responsible method for determining what work is contracted out, what work stays in-house, by requiring cost-benefit analysis and proper oversight. Our members are dedicated workers and taxpayers as well, and they get so frustrated when they see their taxpayer dollars taken advantage of by contractors who game the system. If we don't enact strong contracting standards and accountability now, we'll all continue to lose money and build projects that are less safe and require replacement much faster than they should. So the members of AEE ask you to support the passage of HB 2037 and HB 2867 today.
Representative,
thank you.
Please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lather, I just wanted to say I've followed your researching the bus, contracting out of buses with considerable fascination or worse. I did have a question, though. You said on the bridge engineering that it could have saved $27 million if it had been done in-house. What percentage is that number of the total cost?
I feel like as a professor I should be able to do math in my head. Can I get back to you on that?
Oh, that'd be fine. I just wanted to understand, you know, what that really is in the scheme of the dollars, because it's a lot of money. And that is fine. It's
and give it back to the committee administrator, because I'm curious, too, and we all want to know.
Of course.
It's a considerable amount of money either way you look at it.
I'm sorry. I think I can tell you right here if I... this was... The value of the construction of the bridges was $540 million in terms of total construction costs.
Yeah, but that's not all engineering.
The design costs on that were $67 million. This is the ones that were done by outside consultants. So the $67 million would have been more or less $40 million right. If that work had been done in-house instead of outside. Mm-hmm. I guess those are the essential numbers.
So it's 30-40% somewhere. And my math isn't very good, but it's big. Okay.
It is mine.
Thank you.
Ms. Davis, you're right. After that rebar bends, it's weaker. You don't know if they yarded that cage out of that column form. And on the other bridge support cage you showed where it was going like this, you don't. A lot of times they'll build those cages and just have them hanging there, and then our good carpenter friends will come along, straighten them up, put a form around them, and straighten, plumb them, and level them up. Do you know if that happened or not?
No, sir, I don't. I'm not an engineer, but the folks within our group that got a look at these photographs said that the only way to fix the rebar problem would have been to really just take the whole thing out and start over. Yeah. And pretty much the same issue with that central bridge support as well. The concrete problem would have had to been completely pulled out and redone in order to have it be, to the full strength that it should be.
Just for future reference, it'd be good if you come and show before and after and know for sure it's that. Because I've spent many happy days removing brand-new faulty things that I had nothing to do with. I'm just a laborer with a jackhammer. All these other guys screwed stuff up, and I had to come and do that. So, Representative Cameron, then Representative Witt.
Thank you. Thank you. Speaking of Mr. Chair, tearing things up. Dr. Laffer, I just have a quick question for you. On the ODOT versus the outside engineering, was the question asked of ODOT, did they have the capacity engineers on staff to be able to do these jobs within the time frame that the legislative asked for it to be done?
I can't speak for ODOT, and I did not ask them that question specifically. But these are long-term funding cycles for infrastructure. I mean, what I was looking at are 10 years, but I believe there were kind of 5 years of funding packages approved at a time. And what I can say is that partly in order to address the issue that you were talking about is that I built into the calculations internal overhead for ODOT. So I was not just looking at wages, but internal overhead meaning both, you know, buildings and cars and that, but also management that would be needed. So I can't answer the question exactly, but I think that there's good reason to believe that you could have done this by hiring more staff with the infrastructure, the expanded infrastructure you'd need to have that more staff in place.
Thank you.
Representative Witt, then Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordon, the bill, as I read it, appears to be focused on information used in the awarding of a contract. And I'm wondering from your vantage point if you would see any value in reporting to the public information upon completion of the contract, such things as the timeliness of the goods or services provided, potential cost overruns. Mr. Moulton described shoddy work. I think shoddy materials, information about that might be helpful. I remember some repaving projects on Highway 217 a few years ago, and potentially the truncation of what would be considered a useful life of the contract, presumably materials, but I could imagine some instances where services would be involved as well. Would this be information that you think would be worthwhile for the public?
Chairman Schaffler, Member Witt, absolutely. And it's problems that have come up in this very different areas, you know, construction on the one hand, design, school, you know, custodial services. In all those cases, there are the kind of problems that you refer to, both costs added after a contract is awarded, but also quality problems that come up in the case of custodial services. I know that Sodexo was running a 25% turnover rate, though that has certain costs that you don't see when you first award the contract. So I think, and again, I can't speak to the software costs of compiling the information, but in terms of what would be useful for public agencies deciding to award a contract on is obviously knowing how a contractor performed and not just what they initially bid.
Mr. Chairman, are you aware of any kind of amendments in this regard?
There's all kinds of things going on. These bills are going to be changed tremendously and made better and more acceptable to a broader range of people, I hope. Representative Holby, then Representative Thatcher, and then we got to get going, folks. There's a lot of people signed up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just perhaps had to comment, mostly because I've spent part of my life working on projects similar to this. And, you know, just looking at the failure on that one bridge project, you know, brings to mind all sorts of questions about the oversight of the project, not just by the general contractor, who, as a result of this, should probably never be hired again. And I think that's one of the points of this bill. On another point, the oversight of on-site engineers should have never allowed the construction to allow something like that to happen in the first place. So that particular engineering company probably shouldn't be hired again. And just recently I became aware of a situation where, not just in the actual physical construction, but in a project where certified payrolls were examined on a bridge where there was dozens of
piles driven into the ground, they reported absolutely no pile driver hours on the project. And so that kind of tells me that there, again, is a lack of oversight from the contractor, or looking the other way by the contractor, the construction managers, and the engineers. And when things like that happen, it, I mean, I think this is the point of the bill. We shouldn't be hiring contractors like that, or construction managers like that, or engineering firms that allow that to happen.
I couldn't agree more, Representative, and they're lucky nobody got killed when that cage toppled over.
That's right.
You could be under it, you could be climbing on it. I've climbed on it. Representative Hovey has. Representative Thatcher, please.
Thank you. And, Joelle, I've been in this business since 92, and I remember the days when ODOT was doing all its engineering in-house and then changing over. And in that change, and I think a lot of it had to do with the legislature. The legislature wanted to make sure these projects got out the door, and they got out the door fast. And one of the things that has happened, and this has been told to me by some ODOT people, is that these projects are only, because of the speed in which they're having to get out the door, only 60% designed. Is one thing, is that your, do you know anything about that?
I don't know that I could tell you the exact percentage of you know, what gets designed in and what gets designed out. I can tell you that ODOT did lose a tremendous number of engineers during the, probably between 2000 and 2003 in particular. We lost over 150 positions, and we've had a real problem with a lot of our great engineers going to work for contractors just because the pay has been better, and that's been a real challenge. In the current environment, though, with the engineering firms are struggling because of the downturn in the economy, this could be an excellent time for ODOT to re-recruit some of its folks to come back to restaff and to bring those levels back up so that they can have the capabilities that they once had to do the design on the in-house basis.
Well, I think another thing that happened too is because of the PERS change, we lost a lot of very, very experienced project managers and inspectors to these firms, and so we have a lot of inexperienced people in there now, unfortunately. And what happens too is because we design these, want these jobs to be out the door, and I guess they call them biddable, but they're really, you're given a pile of paper, and here's the project, and you're bidding as well as you can, looking at what the information is and what the standards and specifications say you need to provide. But when they're only 60% designed, plus or minus, you will end up with changes. And changes, and I can't tell you how much I hate those. I loathe them. They are a loser for this person. But anyway, you get these change orders, and they will cause costs to increase. Now, for that to be held against a contractor, I would be really thinking there needs to be more disclosure other than, oh, yeah, costs overran by X percent. There needs to be some explanation attached to that. Perhaps it wasn't because of any fault of the contractor. I just think there's more to the story in cost overruns than simply you know, somebody gaming the system.
Yeah, Representative, I couldn't agree more. If there's a contractor, responsible contractor on a building site, and the contracting agency comes up and hands that him or her with a list of change orders, clearly that's not at the, and I don't think that's not at the fault of the contractor, nor should they be held against them in any way. And I don't think there's anything in this legislation that suggests that. And if there is, we're going to take it out. But back to what you're right, there is a need for speed. At times, contracting agencies in the public realm will contract things out because of speed. But also, there was this idea in the 90s that everything public was bad and everything private was good. Well, that's fallacious. It's not true. We've wasted a lot of money. In some cases, it is true. You can justify it with the cost analysis. Other times, it simply is not true. But we dove off that cliff, and now we're swimming back up to the rocks and trying to climb out. With that, I'm going to let these good people go. We have a lot of Oregonians that want to speak to this, and I may not even get to them all today. And thank you very much. I appreciate it. And while
Darren Jackson and Karen Miller are coming up. I've just scratched down a few. The Lake Oswego bus thing, I thought there was a high school project in my district where the Columbia Pacific Building Trades, Wally Marin said, don't hire this outfit. That outfit did not complete that job. They had to go to bond, hire a union contractor to finish it, if I remember right. There's a junction up there off 205. That job got shut down in the middle of it after they were warned about that contractor. They had to go to their bond, come in 6 months later, start it up and finish it. We've seen the TriMet self-propelled commuter rail cars. They were warned about that. And a good representative down here referred to, there's all kinds of cases where had we had something, and I'm not suggesting everything in here is what we need, but something in place to avoid these cost overruns, incredible neglect, but negligence, by the way. I'll shut up now and let good Oregonians speak to these. Please go, whoever wants to go first. And folks, we have 40 minutes left, and I have about 15 people that want to talk. So let's keep it down to a couple minutes, if we can. Go right ahead.
I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Chair Schauffler, members of the committee, I'm Karen Miller, an Oregon native and a 16-year employee at the Department of Human Services. I am a member of SEIU Local 503, and today I am representing myself and my local. I believe House Bills 2037 and 2867 will improve our contracting process at DHS. I deal with contractors in a variety of ways, including working with contractor staff and working with DHS staff using the products and services of contractors. The primary issues I want to address are the need for information regarding contracts and the need for quality standards and accountability. House Bill 2037 will require transparency through an online database and reports, which will help DHS because it will force us to track our contracts centrally to even put the information online. DHS currently uses a decentralized process. It's hard to know who we are contracting with, where the contractors are in meeting the terms of their contracts, and how much it's costing. By requiring that agencies track this information centrally and make it more readily available, I believe that DHS will save money and be better able to hold contractors accountable. Before coming to DHS, I worked for the U.S. Forest Service. In the Ranger District where I worked, we were dissatisfied with the way that the office was being cleaned. Just rewriting that contract, making expectations around quality clear, and connecting contractor performance to pay resulted in a much cleaner office. And that's why I think Section 1 of House Bill 2867 is so important. Currently at DHS, I don't believe we have adequate accountability measures in our contracts. I work beside many staff who work for contractors, and most of them are great people who are committed to the work. But that doesn't make up for clear accountability measures written into the contracts. We need to do this to ensure that we're using taxpayer dollars effectively and to ensure quality services. Since coming to work for DHS, I've watched several job specialties contracted out. Parent training used to be done by child welfare workers and is now done by contractors, making it harder for our casework staff to track families' progress toward keeping their children safe. Job preparedness training, which was once done by self-sufficiency staff, is now done by higher-paid contractors who lack solid performance measures. These people lure some of our most effective case managers away from state service for higher paid jobs, doing what they used to do for more pay and less accountability. Simple transcription performed by office staff is now contracted out to a firm in Florida at a penny a word, which at 100 words a minute, which isn't extraordinary, adds up to $60 an hour, a lot more than the total compensation of an OS1 or OS2. We need accountability in contracting. We need transparency in contracting and quality services to be guaranteed in response to our tax dollars. If public employees don't do their jobs, they don't get hired back. The same should hold true for contractors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Now I can add all those things onto my list, too. Go ahead.
Well, my name is Darren Jackson, and I come to you today as a concerned SEIU member and a Oregon Native taxpayer. I'm an ex-private contractor, and after years of doing that and being in the private sector, I went to work for ODOT. I'm a coordinator right now for the pavement marking crew. We put all the lines on the road and the turn arrows that you see, anything that's painted on the road or marked on the road as a reflector, we do it region one. I get involved, being a coordinator, I'm involved with writing bids that I have to do to run my own budget so that we have to figure out that where we're going to spend the money and how we're going to spend it, and we've been being asked to do more with less, and through my times of doing this, I've been seeing where we can do more with less, and that is to return part of that back to ourselves instead of the private sector. I have some comparisons that I've written down. The first one that was brought to my attention, or the first two that came to my attention to look into this well before our budget crisis, was examples where contractors could not make it out to complete their tasks. A prime contractor would hire a subcontractor to do the pavement markings on the road. Because of weather, because of breakdowns, they might not be able to make it. The prime wouldn't get the paycheck until the whole job was complete. So they'd call us and, can you do this small task left? We'd go out and do that small task. We would be aware of what was bid in the job for that particular area of the task because the prime was shorted that amount. We could only charge them what it cost us as a state to do. I would run those cost reports, loaded rate, including retirement, health care, lease rate from Salem on our equipment to do that. The first example, one of the most recent ones that I have, was on the reflectors that I just did last summer. We did a stretch on Highway 8 that had a durable marking product that was not visible any longer at night to our satisfaction. We augmented that with reflectors on Highway 8. Our cost was a little over $3 a reflector to actually do the work, install it. That includes the machinery, that includes the traffic control, that includes our loaded rate of employees. Standard bid rate is about $5.50 each. That particular project was a little over 8,000 reflectors. I'll allow you to do the math on just one stretch of road. We've been doing more with less. I have less employees on my crew now than I did the 8 years ago when I started working for the state. We try to keep continuing to do that. Another project that we did was just a small grinding removal. That is to remove the road, we realign it because there was a business that went in. They had to add a bike lane. So the contractor couldn't make it out to do that. We went back out to do that. The bid in the job was a little over $5,000, allowed for the prime to get that to pay his sub to do it. I was on the way out past Oregon City to do another job that night. We stopped in, did it under three people, under less than an hour. That works to about $150. At that time, it was $38 an hour, loaded rate for a state employee, $28 an hour for the small piece of equipment, and one pickup at $9 and something an hour, lease rate from the state. $5,000 versus $150. That's an extreme example. I think the reflectors are more of a close example to it. Part of the transparency of these bills that I've seen that it looks at is to what can we do if the work's not done properly. We do that where the line goes on the road, it's not proper, we have to go back and remove it. The contractor gets the check if it doesn't last. These are durable products, supposed to be 5 years old. And then we have to own that. As a state agency, we own that road. The contractor could be belly up before the warranty's done. The contractor could be long gone. They want to be onto the job making money. Anything that we can do to make these contractors do their work and for us to be on a level playing field to give the opportunity to state employees to do the work themselves and in-house for less cost to the government and the taxpayer. I feel these bills both present themselves in doing that.
Any questions of these good folks? Representative Thatcher. And I'm going to start timing people at 2 minutes because I want to get everybody a chance. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Darren. Mm-hmm. You're mentioning how loaded rate on it. You were able to determine the cost of doing, I think it's pavement markers reflecting all of that. I'm just wondering, do you account risk? How is risk accounted for in those particular, because it is risky going out in the middle of the road and doing that work. It would only take one accident to really impact.
Correct. As a state agency, we're self-insured. My costs are all looked at as what my budget is impacted for my employees to be out there at the loaded rate, what is charged. Region 1's pavement marking budget is $1.4 million per year. So I project, and I just did a projection to try to come in budget, so I know what these projects cost. What my people are being paid, what the materials cost. Now, as far as risk insurance, you know, we run that, and I believe that's carried into each one of our own employees. I'm not sure. I just know what it costs my budget on a whole, or if I was to take that same job and pay a contractor to do it. That's how I'm comparing it.
And that's the kind of question that needs to be asked, and that would have to be brought into any equation figuring out whether you're saving money or not. And it's a fair question. Mm-hmm. It may not be, or may be, penciled into your budget. That I didn't hear that clearly that it was.
I do know that we do have claims to risk management, and we do, you know, the hourly rate on our vehicles is including insurance.
Yeah, it may be. I don't know. But, folks, I got to move on here. I have a bunch of people. I really appreciate you coming in, though. Thank you very much. And we're going to time people at 2 minutes. And at 2 minutes, I'm going to start waving my hands or something and ask you to summarize quickly and briefly. Henry Kramer, Dave Rosenfeld, and Janice Thompson, please. Whoever wants to sit down first and get going, you keep track. Thank you. Go right ahead, sir. Start.
Yeah. Chair Shoffler, members of the committee, Henry Kramer, Oregon Bus Project. And while it is my great shame that I wasn't born in Oregon, I chose to make my home here because it's better than other states.
I got here as fast as I could, too, sir.
Outstanding. Now, my organization, since we were founded in 2002, has, when we approach a political issue, not asked the question, will this forward a liberal agenda or a conservative agenda, but will this be better for the good of Oregon? And I'm here to testify on in favor of House Bills 2037 and 2867 because we can answer yes to that question, to these bills. Now, as I was saying, Oregon is better than most states in a variety of ways. I'd say all states in a variety of ways. We are lagging behind a little bit in terms of government transparency as it pertains to contracts. As I'm sure you've already heard, we rank 42nd in terms of our transparency for government contracts. We can do better than that. We can move ourselves from the back of the pack to the front of the pack by enacting these things that we're talking about today. Creating comprehensive audits can see cost effectiveness, so we can save taxpayer money whenever possible. In these dire economic times, that's the best thing we can hope for. And creating a searchable spending database will help build trust in Oregon's government, particularly for young people who, as Chair Shoffler pointed out, we live most of our lives online already, and this would be very helpful. Now, another transparency bill is moving through this chamber. Representative Thatcher's Bill 2500 is another good transparency bill. We feel that those bills, 2037 and 2500, go hand in glove, and I urge you to pass both of them. Now, transparency shows average citizens where government's doing its job well, where it can do its job better, can help streamline government, and help folks get involved when they think something needs changing. Now, in terms of House Bill 2867, I have less to say about it. It's common sense. If we can save taxpayer money doing contracts, we should contract out. If we can save taxpayer money bringing the job in-house, we should do that. And thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions. I urge you to pass House Bills 2037 and 2867.
Well done, sir. Right on 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Janice Thompson, Democracy Forum Oregon. We're an organization that focuses on increasing participation opportunities in politics and governmental decision-making, which I think goes hand-in-hand with the ideas in this bill, these bills related to government accountability and transparency. My major focus, given our organizational emphasis, is on House Bill 2037, but certainly see that 2867 includes important features like conflicts of interest provisions, and in general, you know, support the idea that outlining contracting standards certainly contributes to public confidence and saving the public resources. Focusing on 2037 certainly just seems like another example of bringing government into the internet age, with its emphasis on online online accessibility and searchability in a centralized database. Just a very important concept. You've heard previous testimony. It's where we're headed in any number of areas, and it's particularly important in this area because contracts transparency, I think, facilitates oversight by the public and the press that in turn increases public trust in this government function and government in general. Now, just as current laws regarding contracts applies to all levels of government, it also looks appropriate in 2037 that the disclosure requirements are widely applicable. With a flexibility allowed to local governments to send data to the DAS website or to create their own website at their own discretion. And so I think that flexibility is part of what you had, Representative Barton, has concerns about, you know, how this fits for everybody, and I think that's a feature that makes it, provides, like I say, needed flexibility, particularly from the local government end. And then finally, in addition to the emphasis of the bill on transparency on individual contractors, certainly support the notion of aggregating the data to facilitate analysis of bigger picture trends in state and local government contracting. And with that, I just urge your support.
Thank you. I have 12 people. I got 25 minutes. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, got 3 points. Dave Rosenfeld with Osprey. First thing is that the good people over at DAS, Department of Revenue, Secretary of State, have over the years created pockets of transparency 2.0. We, however, are not the model that we should be. We can totally be the model. That's the first thing. Second, that there's no need for us to reinvent the wheel. As the folks this morning earlier showed us, the model already exists for how to do this. We can basically take open source software, apply it here. We've been shown in other states we can do this stuff for existing costs. So let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's just one-up everybody else and just show them how we can do it for even cheaper and better. That's number two. And number three is that this bill that we're hearing today is really one of a trinity of bills that are going through. Henry mentioned the other one, which is Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher's Bill 2500, which is excellent. There's also a bill with Representative Shields that would take care of the all-important aspect of economic development subsidies and showing the sunshine for that. We should do all three, and all three complement each other very, very well. This could be a watershed session for transparency where we basically turn Oregon into the leader that we should be. And we're looking forward to working with everybody to see that become a reality.
There's several lobbyists signed up. I'm going to go with people that aren't here every day, and that's just the way it is. And we will be hearing these bills again. People will get another chance to testify if they absolutely have to on the amended. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Victor Musel, Dick Volker, and Tim or Jim Tift.
Jim Tift.
Okay, sit on down and go for it. I'm going to put these two up next.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dick Walker. I work in the grounds department for the Lincoln County School District. Prior to that, I was 2003. I was a custodian for 22 years. Lincoln County School District, as the good professor alluded to earlier, contracted out services, custodial, food services, and busing. I was part of the custodial outsourcing. At the time, we had a very good wage and benefit package. When the contractor came in, they eliminated all the custodians. They didn't eliminate them. They fired them, in essence, and hired back custodians at a much lower wage. The RRFP required that they be actively involved in schools as part of the contract. They had never worked in a school before. They were awarded the contract. So, to me, that was a bit of a mystery. Their hiring practices were a bit skewed. We had to hire people at a lower wage. We didn't get quality or qualified people. Sometimes I was asked to hire the people and hire the people and then worry about their background checks later. And I was reluctant to do that. And so one of them actually told me, well, I can't pass the background check. And why not? Well, I have some problems with it. Obviously, I didn't hire the fellow. I said all that to say I support 2037, House Bill 2037, 2867, in the hopes that these two bills would eliminate some of those kinds of problems. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Go ahead. Whoever wants to go first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Tift, and today I'm proud to be an OSEA field representative for the Columbia River and North Coast. Prior to taking my current position, I worked for the Rainier School District for 15 years. I was the OSEA chapter president representing classified employees when the district decided to contract out student transportation and custodians. At the time, Rainier had a very stable workforce. Bus drivers averaged over 17 years of experience. All but four of the 21 drivers lived within the district. And between them, we had 32 of our children that were enrolled in our schools. These families lived, worked, and spent money in our community. They took pride in their jobs, their buses, and their students. They went the extra mile for safety, making sure each bus was regularly inspected, thoroughly steam cleaned undercarriage, and inspected frame front to rear. They did this even though it was not required by straight regulations, because keeping our equipment in top shape and our students safe was a matter of pride. Today, I don't know the employees' experience at the bus barn because we don't really get to know each other. There's no communication between district staff and the drivers anymore. We still have seven of the original 21 drivers who were in the transportation department when they were contracted out. One of these drivers tells me she's only received 75-cent raise in the 5 years since they've contracted out the services. You'd think since they aren't paying their drivers, they could afford to pay the district for the use of their buildings and grounds they occupy. They lease the buildings and grounds from the district for $1 a year. This includes utilities, upkeep, and maintenance of the buildings. When Rainier contracted out custodial services, instead they got janitorial services. Custodians do more than clean. They perform general maintenance, they paint, they move furniture, replace ceiling tiles, change light bulbs, make minor or less electrical and plumbing repairs, help repair playground equipment, and assist with other needs to be done in school. I recall one of our custodians working out one summer with the maintenance crew, painting the building, and that was a savings of over $80,000 in itself. I thank you for supporting us, and I recommend we support House Bill 2867.
You know, when Dr. Lafer was with us 2 years ago or 4 years ago talking about Lake Oswego, I called my school district and David Douglas, another largest district, asked him about their school buses, and both districts told me they would never sell their buses, and I'm glad to hear my daughter's district does that. So go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning and testify on behalf of House Bill 2867 and 2037. My name is Victor Musial. I'm the Director of Operations for the Oregon School Employees Association. I've been involved in the labor movement for over 20 years now as a professional. I have more comments to make, but considering time, I'll just touch on a few. You heard Dr. Lafer talk about Lake Oswego. Clearly, we've been tracking that. One thing that moved that Lake Oswego piece was the Laidlaw salesperson telling the district that it's going to cost them $2 million to replace their buses. That kind of nudged them into the contract mode. So when they sell the buses, though, there's the big problem, is we're paying for them still, and they're using them wherever they want. Laidlaw was bought out by First Student about a year or two ago. And in Malala River School District, where First Student has an operation, at the end of every school year, they take the buses to Gresham, where they rent them out and charter them. Just this past January, I was returning from Central Oregon on a business trip, and as I was driving past Seven Feathers Casino, what do I see in the parking lot? Well over a dozen First Student school buses in the parking lot of a casino. Now, I can't imagine any curriculum that would consider it viable for an educational piece to take children to a casino. It just doesn't make sense. So they're putting miles on these buses. That increases the rate of replacement. The other problems that we have is that when these people are contracted out, they lose money. There's about a 40% reduction in wages and benefits. That's 40 cents on the dollar not turning over in the community. It's leaving the community, in many cases leaving the country. So it has a ripple effect. And these people, when they lose their jobs to contractors, they want to find better jobs with benefits. They'll leave the city, and they'll take their kids with them. And then we have decreasing enrollment as well. I appreciate your time the opportunity to present this information. I have additional documents to support this, these claims, and some analysis by some other folks that I ask be included in the record as well.
I appreciate your time, too, and thanks for coming. I'm sorry. I'm rushing people along. I'd be willing to make a good bet that those buses weren't there. The field trip for a hospitality industry.
Field trip.
Yeah.
Oh, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, I just wanted to let Mr. Tiff know how much I appreciate his presence here today and his testimony. He's a constituent of mine, and I'm very proud of his statement and the fine representation that he does for our mutual constituents. So,
thank you for that, and thank you for your service. Bob Baldwin and Laura Alexander, please. Go ahead, Bob, while you're sitting there. Get going.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. My name is Robert Baldwin. I am a member of the Oregon Public Purchasing Association. I'm certified by the National Institute of Government Purchasing. I am the purchasing coordinator for Lane Community College. I've served in that position for approximately a dozen years. I am the only purchasing professional employed by the college. Pardon me. I also have a master's degree in accounting, so I have seen these issues from every possible perspective. The critical issue that we have at Lane is that we spend millions of dollars every year on contracts which are either not publicly bid because they're exempted completely from competitive bidding, or because they are let through a quote process where we can select exclusively which vendors are allowed to participate in the process. As a consequence of that, we have easily $20 to $30 million a year that goes out that the vending community in general is not able to participate in. We need the reporting process not only for union purposes and for internal efficiencies, but to carry out the stated public policy in the procurement code, which is to promote competition in the marketplace. It will do that because it will allow vendors to know what kind of business agencies are doing year in and year out and what the dollar values are and how to participate in that. I understand there are a lot of amendments that are being proposed. I would urge with great emphasis that if there are dollar thresholds, that they be looked at in an aggregate by service. An example, we laid off the college's only plumber. With all benefits, he made approximately $75,000 a year. Year to date, we have spent $95,000 on plumbing services. But it's not a $95,000 contract. It's a series of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 contracts. So if you don't have a reporting system that is based on the aggregate, you'll never see that. That also speaks to the need for the cost-benefit analysis. That was never done. We've done the same with electricians who've retired and not been replaced, and we let those jobs out $5,000 here, $10,000 here, $15,000 here. We do have a certain process that looks at these, but it's entirely within the labor context. I'm also president of the Classified Employees Union, and I'll tell you that when I go in and argue that, I have a vested interest in promoting a certain cost analysis, just as management does. And it's never made public. A cost analysis that is made public and opened up to some scrutiny by all the interested parties will be a better cost-benefit analysis. That's why we need both of these bills. We need to have the public involved in this process, not just internal squabbles over how to deal with this. I do want to address one thing, and I understand Representative Holvey has left.
You're well over 2 minutes, sir. I'm being real flexible with you. Let's wrap it up. Thank you. Go ahead, ma'am.
My name's Laura Alexander. I'm with Robert Gray Partners Incorporated. We're a general contractor. We build schools. And I support both of these bills with great modifications. I believe that House Bill 2037 will expose the exorbitant costs associated with CMGC consultants and fees, which is a percentage of the end cost of the project. The services are a duplication of services already provided by engineers, plumbing, electrical, and mechanical, and general contractors, which I believe will lead to a cap on the fees that a CMGC consultant can charge. I was concerned about some of the wording that's used inside of some of these House bills, particularly House Bill 2867, and I believe that Section 2.2A may injure a contractor where there may be a conflict in regards to, being a general contractor, we are constantly confronted with representatives from, say, a school or a neighborhood that may not have a comprehensive understanding of construction in itself. One prime example is we had a owner's representative that was hired, had no construction experience whatsoever, and he said that we had built a concrete slab in error because there were cracks. Well, concrete does crack, and there are certain standards that actually are associated with that, and we well exceeded the standards. So in regards to that, 2.2A, it talks about withholding monies based on basically an opinion that may not be educated, and I was concerned about that. I was also concerned about other areas that were inside of this bill. I'm sure that all of you as experts in construction may be able to recognize some of these as well. And one other item that I felt was of concern was the word responsible, deeming whether someone was a responsible contractor or not responsible. That wording should be replaced altogether. It should actually state what they mean by that, because later on, as we well know, when it comes to interpretation of contracts, there may be an entity that may argue with that where the initial intent is dissolved. And I strongly urge you to pass these, but with great modification.
On the contractor side, I'd hope you and your clients go line by line down there, because you're exactly right. All concrete cracks. So with that, I appreciate you coming, and we're going to spend more time on this, folks. And I know I'm running through a lot of people here, but people come down here today, and I want to make sure they have an opportunity to at least get up here for a couple minutes and speak. So I apologize for my rudeness and rushing, but that's just what. Thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate your testimony. With that, Lorna Youngs and Diane Lancaster, please. Go right ahead.
Representative Schaffer, members of the committee, Diane Lancaster for the record from the Department of Administrative Services. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the department and am a longtime professional in this arena. We are very enthused and very excited to see these bills surface. It is wonderful to be talking about making data-based decisions in contracting, and House Bill 2037 certainly is an easy bill to support in the sense of transparency. There are some issues, certainly, as we know, in the state of Oregon's infrastructure about accounting systems and procurement systems and trying to move all this information to a common website where it can be seen. We have been working with the proponents of House Bill 2500, and I've been pleased to hear that there's recognition of this triad of bills, and I think there's room for a lot of work together to create a phased implementation approach so we can get some things going as quickly and as cheaply as possible, and then see what is next. House Bill 2867 likewise broad in scope, and certainly the theme of responsible contracting and knowing what our costs are before we go to contract, setting measurable expectations for contractors to achieve and to perform. These are admirable. The Department of Administrative Services supports the themes and the concepts of both these bills, and we're eager to work with the proponents to come to bill amendments that will make them doable. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lorna Young, Deputy Director with the Department of Transportation. I've given you some written testimony on 2037. I won't go over that. I would like to echo the words of Ms. Lancaster. The Department of Transportation is in support of transparency. We do have a multitude of data systems, so we see this as an opportunity of a win-win situation for us to develop the kind of single point of data that is needed in order to respond to the bill. We'd also like to echo that we feel that a phased approach would be most useful given the magnitude of the changes that are being asked for, and we stand willing and ready to work with the committee to make whatever changes are appropriate to make the goals of this bill work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you checking it out, and I look forward to hearing from you about the amendments. Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to call Chuck Bennett, Lori Sappenspiel, and Brian Smith. Are they outside? Well, there's Chuck. Go ahead, Chuck, let her rip.
Thanks.
2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, in the spirit of nothing's perfect, we're all set to work with you, your committee, and the proponents of these bills to both accomplish their goals and to improve on them. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, sir. Go ahead, Lori.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lori Sappenspiel, Oregon School Boards. Also echoing Chuck's comments and of the several previous speakers, we want to be able to work with you. One piece that districts and our school business officials, apologize, I've got a nasty head cold. Some of the contracting out for specifics that districts may not have expertise in is a must, and I just want you to be aware of that. And with that, in the hall, Association of Oregon Counties and Special Districts also have issues, and they did not get to sign up today, so they wanted me to carry their water. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. My name is Brian Smith. I'm the Acting Purchasing Manager for Multnomah County, and I distributed more detailed notes, but in the interest of time, we also are prepared and interested in working towards some common resolution here on this, but there are a couple of things I just wanted to point out in this, and that is for local jurisdictions, the effect of that this legislation would have in terms of the cost for implementation and the time cutting. And there are several specific portions of these pieces of legislation too, that for Multnomah County, which contracts primarily for health and human services, and much less for the construction kinds of things that we've been hearing folks talk about, it's important to remember. And I just wanted to cite a couple of things from House Bill 2037. A significant portion of Multnomah County's 1,000 contracts a year are treatment services, which are subject to HIPAA privacy restrictions, including billing and treatment information. In addition, there's a variety of treatment-related pool services, such as scheduling, record-keeping, and billing, which are not tracked or charged on an hourly basis on contracts. Pooled or fee services are typical in other types of contracts covered by HB 2037, including services that Multnomah County provides to the state. The county is currently unable to collect and maintain some information required by HB 2037 for hours worked and amounts paid to each person for a variety of pooled or fee services provided to the state. So it's important that as we look at the scope of this, that we remember for human services contracting, there's some other problematic issues as well. The other piece I just wanted to recommend was in 2867, the Section 5 that does not allow us to contract out for overseeing public contracts, that in for an agency such as ourselves that doesn't do a lot of large capital construction contracts, when they do come across, we really need to hire the help because we're not able to afford to keep it on a full-time basis. So that is an important consideration.
I really appreciate it. Clackamas County is generously not going to testify. I'm probably going to make a work group here. It's probably going to be a pretty large work group. We're going to have to hammer this out. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. You guys are in the building, so I'm going to say get out of here for now.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to call John Killen, John Rakowitz, and Marshall Koba. And then we're going to be done for the day. And Melissa, Ms. Unger, wherever you are, you're going to get a chance. Oh, there she is right there. Okay. Thank you, Melissa, for being so understanding. Melissa with SEIU. I just wanted everybody to know she's here, but we hadn't heard from a lot of her folks. Go ahead. Whoever wants to go first.
I guess I was first on the list. My name is John Killen. I'm representing both independent electrical contractors and associate builders and contractors. We don't have a position on 2037. We do, however, oppose 2867 in its current format. I'm not an efficiency expert, but I do know a little bit about contracting law, and these bills in their current iteration are not going to be upheld. They're redundant at best and probably harmful at worst. Thank you.
Thank you. John, you want to go ahead?
Yes, for the record, John Rakowitz with AGC of Oregon. I do want to, for the record, clear up the world of contracting is a complex world. We believe the breadth and depth of this bill as it currently stands is not supportable by our members. At the same time, I want to say accountability, transparency, et cetera. AGC has long been on the record on this. Last session, I believe it was this committee that worked the bill that increased our standards in our industry dramatically. I take angry phone calls every week from contractors for doing that, but that's the right thing to do. And we another way of explaining how we do that is we want to go on the record today for ODOT. If there's a transportation package, we want them to have the engineering and project management talent on board on their staff to do the job right. So we are very serious about accountability and transparency. I would add, though, that I've spent a lot of my life in government, local and state. A couple of years ago, spent 6 months trying to unravel one state agency's backlog of 60 or 70 contracts, mostly the cities and counties with infrastructure. Many of those contracts had not been let after 180 days. The world that we're talking about here, we just ask that take that kind of one little agency, one little problem that we're talking about here, and think about the kinds of consequences this bill could have. We would be happy to engage in a work group or in any other manner. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this opportunity. Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. We are here today with concerns about House Bill 2037 and 2867. We have about 110 firms in Oregon with about 3,000 employees. Our members have been serving the needs of Oregon's taxpayers for years based upon a concept of fair, balanced, mutually beneficial, and complementary design services that add value, expertise, timeliness, and quality results. One of the ways that we do that is through our procurement process called qualification-based selection, and it's an issue that's been before this body for the last 10 years. QBS requires that it's not federal government and a lot of state contracts, it's not a bid process where the designer is retained, but through a qualification-based system where the local government or state government develops a list and the highest-ranked firm then is chosen in a fair price. Understanding a full scope of the work is what is the price is based upon. So we've heard a lot of discussion here about the engineers today. I look forward to working with the work group, Mr. Chair, and I haven't had an opportunity to see the work done by the good doctor from the University of Oregon. Look forward to reading that report and responding to it. Thank you.
Thank you. And just so you guys know, I'm shorting you on time here, but definitely you will be involved in this because I have to have you involved in this. I want to have you involved in this. And local governments, Oregon cities, I'd imagine, Association of Counties, the various state departments, labor, There's a lot going on here. It's going to take a lot of work, and we're not. I would be willing to put a small wager that we aren't going to get it all done this year. But we may get. I'd like to see us get somewhere on this. I think if we can save money, be more efficient, I think that's good for everybody. With that, I'm going to let you guys go, and then I am generously going to allow Melissa Unger to come on up here, and she's been waiting patiently. And I was going to carry her over, but go ahead, Melissa, let her rip, and then we're going
to
finish.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, I want to make this really quick. I just wanted to make sure everyone has a sense. This fact sheet's going to come around, and it has the logos of all the groups who have been working together on this bill, and I think that's an important thing to know, is that it comes from a variety of experiences. We know it's really broad. We've been working. We've already sat down with AOC, the counties, the cities, the special districts, DAS, and ODOT. We understand that there needs to be changes to these bills. We're very excited to work with the committee to do that. I wanted to make sure to put that on the record. And then also, a lot of the stuff that's in these bills came from a variety of different reports and all that information. And there's actually an online vehicle at www.OregonGovernmentAccountability.com where we've kind of put everything up on the website so people can go and get that information. So those are the points that I just wanted to make very quickly.
And Melissa, and,
yes,
if you would, rather than have one person from all these organizations, if you would find one or two, maybe three, rather two, We don't want 30 people in the room. It's very unwieldy. It's hard to work. It's hard to get anything done. We'll discuss the issues. You go back and discuss it with the larger group, whatever group it is. I ask this of all of you out there, whether you're from private business, labor, the various departments, local governments. Let's try to have a smaller group, and then you can report back to your larger constituency. We can all meet again and go over and hash it over, but I don't want 30 people in the room. It's impossible to get anything done. I'd like to keep it down to like a dozen folks if we could. So
We will do what we can. Let's finish
Thank you. Thank you very much. With that, I really appreciate everyone coming and your patience. I hope you understand the crunch on time. I'm going to close the hearing on both bills, and we're adjourned.